Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Mr. Daniels, can you give us an assessment of where you are right now as far as come Sunday?
It's up to the doctor. It's not my decision.
For you, I mean, where do you think you're at? And
I feel good.
That was Chick Hernandez, it sounded like, with Jaden Daniels yesterday. Jaden wasn't talking much, although there were a couple of things he said that could have been clues to what will happen on Sunday. A busy Thursday show for us today. It'll start with our good friend Mark Zuckerman from Mass and Sports at 10:35. Mark will jump on and tell us about the new Nats hire, 35-year-old from Boston, to become the new president of baseball ops. By the way, baseball really getting exciting down the stretch. Cleveland has now overcome and taken the lead in the American League Central. If you're not paying attention to it, the Guardians, were 15 and a half games back on July 8th behind Detroit. They were 10 and a half back on September 1st. They've won 17 of 19. They're in first place. Cal Raleigh hit home runs 59 and 60 last night. Big time division races and wild card races coming down to the final regular season weekend in baseball. We'll have October playoff baseball next week. Looking forward to that. By the way, today for our football team, Cliff Kingsbury will speak before practice, Joe Witt Jr. As well. And then we'll find out, you know, when they practice, if Jaden is limited again, full, or something else. We'll also learn more, I would assume, about Terry's situation. Denton's going to jump on with us this morning. He'll do it at 11 to talk about what is truly one of the better college football football weekends, Saturdays in recent memory. Charch will be with us at 11:25. Brian DiArdo from CBSSports.com will jump on with us at noon to talk NFL, maybe a little Ryder Cup as well. So, yeah, yesterday was, you didn't get much, you know, from Quinn first and then Jaden second. Jaden's press conference lasted 4 minutes and 44 seconds. Every single answer, with the exception of three of them, were, you know, seven words or less. Up to the doctors, not my decision. I feel good was another answer. No was another answer. Something to get used to. Another answer. Nah, I'm myself. Another answer. He looked a bit, and I watched it, he looked a bit, you know, irritated. Jaden's not super comfortable, and you can tell he doesn't enjoy this part of the job, which I kind of like about him. There were a couple of things that he said, though, that I just wanted to talk through, Max. We don't even have to play it, because I think you needed to watch the answer as much as hear it. He was asked, I'm pretty sure, by Keim, about whether or not he can run and cut. You know, how much running and cutting has he been able to do? And he perked up a bit, and he said, enough to feel good if I play on Sunday. And then he said, but it's not my decision. It's the doctor's decision. And then he was asked about wearing a knee brace. He said he's never worn one before. He has been wearing one, reportedly, since the Green Bay game. He said it would be something he would have to get used to. And then when he was asked whether he would have to wear a knee brace if he ends up playing on Sunday in Atlanta, he said, quote, the doctors haven't made that decision yet, so that would be a conversation, closed quote. That answer, just if we're looking for clues about Sunday, I think that conversation may have already taken place if there was a good chance that he was going to play on Sunday about the brace. Doctors haven't made that decision yet. That would be a conversation. Maybe not. Maybe it would happen later on in the week after he had practiced with the knee brace. We know he was limited yesterday. We don't really know what that means in terms of how much he took in terms of first team reps, etc. That question did not come up in the presser with him. But I think, and of course, we're 2.5 hours away from perhaps looking silly, not we, but me, I think he's not playing Sunday. I think if he were playing Sunday, he would have been a full go yesterday. Now, if he's a full go today, or if he's limited today, full go Friday, that obviously will mean he's in. If he gets that full participant, of course, you know, Friday, it's not what level of practice. You then get your status as to whether or not you're in, questionable, or out. My gut right now is that he's not going to play Sunday in Atlanta, and they're going to give it one more week. Of course, if he doesn't go in Atlanta, we'll have a lot of questions as to what this injury, not that the questions haven't been there already, but at that point, it's like, okay, you know, when this happened, it was probably a 2 to 4 week injury, somewhere in that range, and we're now just figuring that out, that's exactly what it was. I hope he plays. I do. I think this is going to be a tough game Sunday in Atlanta. But my hunch is he won't play. And I feel the same way about Terry as well. I think Terry more likely is going to be out. By the way, there was a surprise on the injury report when it came out yesterday. Bill was on it with a knee. Now, some of the reporting is that they don't think that's a serious injury with Bill Kroski Merritt. So hopefully he will be able to go on Sunday as well. This from Otter. Thank you, Otter. Animal House Otter. Why didn't you mention London Fletcher or Brian Mitchell when you were talking about the Hall of Fame list? Yeah, my bad yesterday. I didn't see the whole list. I saw the headline that said Breeze and Larry Fitzgerald named to the, you know, nominated for Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2026. And what struck me when I saw those two is eligible, they're in. Like, to me, they are no-brainers. When you think as a football fan, like, you know, Hall of Famers, those two are immediate Hall of Famers. You know, the debatables from last year, you know, Eli and Philip Rivers, they did not get in. I still think both will get in, and I think both I actually think Rivers deserves it more. But I think eventually both will get in. Well, Drew Brees is in the conversation of top 15 QBs, worst case top 20 of all time. He's in. Larry Fitzgerald is probably up there in the top 5, worst case top 7 or 8 wide receivers of all time. I don't even know where Larry Fitzgerald's numbers are. I should check those. But he's got to be way up there on all of the pass reception.
Larry has more career tackles than drop passes. Did you know that stat?
Yeah, I've heard that before. Yes, I've actually heard that. Larry Fitzgerald on the all-time pass reception list. Where is he? Number two in yards. Okay, receiving yards. Receptions. He is number two. He's number two behind Jerry Rice in both receptions and yardage. So, yeah, he's an absolute lock. Where is he on the touchdown list? He's got to be
sixth.
He's sixth on the touchdown list. It's Rice, Moss. Yeah, like, I think when you think about receivers, you think about Jerry Rice won. I think it's the one position, and I've talked about this before, when you're debating the greatest at a position in the history of the game, it's the one position more than any other that gets no debate. Like, Jerry Rice is the greatest wide receiver in the history of the game, and if you're an NFL fan, you can't find more than a few to dispute you. Whereas every other position, even quarterback, you know, with Brady's kind of GOAT status, you'll get debate at quarterback. But after Rice, it's like, it's Moss, it's Fitzgerald. I think Randy Moss, in terms of talent, would probably be number two on that list for me. But Larry Fitzgerald's up there. The receptions list, where is Moss on the reception list? Because he had kind of a... Yeah, Moss is 18th on the reception list, which speaks to kind of the greatness. Larry Fitzgerald, number two. You know, T.O. would be in the conversation. Yeah. Those two jumped out. It's like, that's the first time we've had something where it's been so obvious that they're getting in. But Otter, yes, London Fletcher and Brian Mitchell on the 128 modern era players nomination list for the Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2026. To me, Jake is the, you know, he's no longer modern era. Jake is the big missing piece from Canton for our franchise's history. You know, you could certainly debate guys like Larry Brown and Brian Mitchell and Gary Clark. Gary Clark's resume actually, you really stacks up well with some receivers that are in the Hall of Fame. I think if he plays his entire career in the NFL instead of combo USFL and NFL, I think Gary Clark is in the Hall of Fame had he played his entire career in the NFL. I don't think, as much as I, you know, Brian Mitchell's actually, when he, I think he knows the way I feel about him, he's actually one of my all-time favorite players because I think he's one of the all-time clutch players in franchise history, but I don't think he's a Hall of Famer. I think he's worthy of the conversation, as he has gotten many times. I don't think he'll ever get there. He and Cribbs are the two returners on the list. And even though you can compare favorably London Fletcher's career to some linebackers, middle linebackers who are in the Hall of Fame, I don't think London will make it there either. I mean, an all-time Iron Man for our franchise and a great player. Was he the best middle linebacker of the era? No, Ray Lewis was. But I think both are absolutely year in and year out worthy of being on these lists and being narrowed down to, you know, the final 50 list or even the final 25 list. I think Jake's the one that has the best case and has had the best case to be in the Hall of Fame, and he's not there. And he would be at the top of my list for players in the history of the franchise that are not in the Hall of Fame that should be. But once again, for Brian and for London, congrats. And we are rooting for you. And I did not mean to omit them from the conversation yesterday. I just saw the headline on Breeze and on Larry Fitzgerald. All right. So wanted to read this because I think it sets up an interesting, just brief conversation. And it's not actually one of those in which it's reality. It's very much a hypothetical. But it comes from Dave. Dave writes, "Hi, Kevin. It seems like Jaden is trending towards playing while Terry might miss this week." I don't know if Jaden's trending towards playing, but obviously at this point, because he was limited yesterday and he was out last week, there's a better chance. Dave continues, "For just this week, do you think the team is more likely to win with Jaden playing and Terry out, or how we had it last week with Mariota and Terry in? I think there's a strong case that Terry is more irreplaceable right now for this offense. I think Jaden is by far the most valuable player on our team, but I feel a little bit more nervous about the offense this week than I did last week." That's a would you rather for us, Max. Would you rather Mariota Terry or Jaden no Terry this week? Again, that's not reality because I think Terry's going to be out. So I don't think we've got that option. But it is interesting to consider. My answer is immediately, oh, no, no, no. Like, this isn't that hard. Jaden, 100%, you got to have him. Especially a road game against a team that has the ability to play well and will be chomping at the bit to get back out there after being embarrassed last week in Charlotte against the Panthers. I said this yesterday. I think this is going to be a bit of a snake pit that they go into in terms of the opponent, not necessarily the crowd. The Atlanta crowd's okay. You know what? In Atlanta, there are always a lot of Washington fans anyway because of the network of Washington fans that went far south for so long and the number of people that grew up Redskin fans in that part of the country, the Southeast. But I think you're going to get an absolute jacked up, ready to play Falcon team. And they've got players. They've got very good skill position players. They've got a good offensive line. They've got a better defense than they had last year. Their quarterback right now is the shaky player on their roster. But give me Jaden in a game like that. And I'll be, you know, I'd rather do that without Terry. Of course, the issue here is it's not just no Terry. It may be no Terry, no Noah Brown, no John Bates on offense. And that's problematic overall. Terry will be missed, okay? Someone else sent me an email, and I'm looking for it right now, that just said, why all the fuss about Terry? Didn't you tell us that the team's win total wouldn't change without him? First of all, I didn't say that. I said it would change very little. But I also said that they can't win the Super Bowl or contend for the Super Bowl without Terry. They need Terry. He's their best receiver. But you are right. I minimized, very much so, the loss of a receiver like Terry to the overall season win total. You know, it would be about a game. I think I said max two games. And maybe none. But that's also from the perspective of how the odds makers would put it out there. The over-under with Terry getting injured or being a holdout or not playing would not have changed at all heading into this season. Quarterbacks change that number. A dominant defensive player changes that number. Occasionally, another skill position player on offense will impact that. But we're talking about the Saquon Barkleys and the Jamar Chases of the world, not, you know, Terry. But, of course, they're going to miss him. But back to the would you rather. I would rather have Jaden out there at 100% on Sunday. I would. I think this will be a much tougher game for whomever is playing quarterback than Sunday was. Sunday was a get-right scenario. It was the perfect setup for all of the reasons we talked about last week. Washington well-rested, Raiders not well-rested, Raiders not a really good football team overall, major issues along their offensive line, traveling west to east for a 1 o'clock kick, all of those reasons. This one is not that setup. This is a better football team, a hungry and desperate football team playing at home against a team right now that is wounded in a lot of areas. So give me the most valuable player in the franchise at the most important position on the field. That would be what I would rather have play out if that were an actual choice, which it isn't. But for, you know, sports talk, hypothetical purposes, Max, which of the two would you choose?
It's tough for me just because Actually, you know, the more that I think about it, it's not that tough. Because when you look at how the Falcons played us last year, what did Terry do in that game, Kevin? Didn't he have one catch for like 4 yards? So
was that what it was? I don't even remember.
I believe so. I know it was less than 10. That's for damn sure.
Look, him being on the field, though, is impactful
for
versus
sure.
Not being on the field.
Yeah, absolutely. It draws eyes and all that. But at the same time, Jaden offers so much more of a dynamic skill set than Terry at such a paramount position that we have to go into this game with Jaden and no Terry if we had that option. So that I would be picking Jaden and riding with my guy.
Wow. I didn't remember it this way. What I remember about that game, okay, they clinched the postseason, a playoff berth, Sunday night football. The game got, you know, flexed to Sunday night. It was Michael Penix Jr.'s first legitimate start. He had played the week before against the Giants, who were horrible. And Jaden basically in that fourth quarter, second half, and overtime strapped the team to his back. I just pulled up the box score. I should go look at my notes to see what I said about Terry because I don't remember offhand. Jaden was 24 of 36 for 227 yards, three touchdowns, one pick, but rushed for 127 yards on 16 carries. We remember that overtime drive. Terry, one catch on seven targets. Did he have a bunch of drops that night? It's not like he didn't get targeted. Why did he only have one catch on seven? He got targeted more than anybody except for Zaccheaus.
He was getting bracketed. That I do know. Like, they had Bates over the top, and then they had A.J. Terrell basically sticking with Terry pretty much the entire game. So he was just in hell, apparently.
Really?
From what I remember, that's how I recall it. Because I remember Bates would be following him around up top, and then Terrell was moving to whichever side of the field that Terry was on. They were like, Terry is not going to be the one to beat us. Make Jaden do it. And he did it, to his credit.
Seven targets, one catch, 5 yards. Interesting. Yeah, I'm looking through just the notes to see if Jaden had a bunch of drop passes in that game. What a game that was. Hell of a football game. This will be different, I do think. My notes, connection with Terry off all night. Seven targets, one catch. A.J. Terrell played really well against Terry. A.J. Terrell might be on the injury report. Check that. I think he's on the injury report for the Falcons this week. I think they're missing a corner this week, potentially, and I think it's Terrell, who's a very good corner. That would be big. That could be huge. Look, if they trot out, you know, a true skeleton crew wide receiver group, you know, led by Debo, but not being the true receiver, more of an overall weapon. But you've then got no Noah Brown, no Terry. So you're out there with Chris Moore, who got the second most snaps last week, Luke McCaffrey, Jalen Lane, you know, bringing up Ja'Cory Brooks from the practice squad. That's going to be a challenge for either quarterback. It's going to be one of those games where the backs are going to be a big part of everything they do, I would imagine. AJ, could be a huge game for McNichols. What did you say?
A.J. Terrell currently DNP with a hamstring injury, which we know a lot about corners with hamstring injuries, don't we, Kev?
Yeah, we do. That's, I guess, in my notes from that game last year, A.J. Terrell, great job on Terry. Okay. We're going to talk some baseball with Mark Zuckerman coming up in about 12 minutes. I've got a what do you got or two when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. Don't forget, you can watch us on our Team 980 YouTube channel. Hit the subscribe button, hit the like button when you get there.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
So the SEC is unveiling, this is SEC football, every team's conference opponents for the next four football seasons. They are going to an expanded schedule, but they're going to three finalized annual protected rivalries per school. The SEC is loaded with rivalries. I mean, among the top 100 rivalries in college football, a list put together by the New York Times a few years ago, 27 of them were SEC matchups. 27, more than a quarter of them were SEC matchups. So the traditional annual protected rivalries list has come out, and it has really generated a lot of feedback, and primarily negative feedback, starting with the fact that Alabama and LSU, they have been playing each other since 1964. And in 12 of the matchups over the period of time, at least one of the teams was ranked either number one or number two. Alabama LSU has become a staple of early November in college football. LSU does not have Alabama as a protected rival. Alabama does not have LSU as a protected rival. Starting in 2027, that game won't be played every year. It'll be played some years, but it won't be played every year. That is very disappointing to college football fans, not just SEC fans. I went to an Alabama-LSU game in Death Valley. It is easily top two or three all-time sporting events I've ever attended live. I've said this many times before. We got there 4 hours before kickoff. Kickoff was 6 p.m. local time, 7 p.m. Eastern time. We got there 2 o'clock local time, and it felt like we were 24 hours late for the party, which was incredible. Tennessee-Florida could not be preserved in an ongoing thing. God, do you remember the 90s in Tennessee-Florida with Peyton Manning, with Spurrier, and all of the big Tennessee-Florida games over the years? That game is not being protected. These are not crossover rivals, protected rivals. Alabama and Georgia is not going to be protected. Look, we have not seen Alabama and Georgia play in the regular season a lot. We've seen them play for an SEC title and twice for the college football playoff title, but that's not a big deal. How about Tennessee-Georgia being lost? I mean, Tennessee-Georgia, that's the game of the year so far in college football. That seemed like an absolute given in, you know, September, early October in college football. LSU-Florida has been a rivalry going back to 1971. That is going to end as well. Yeah, it stinks for college football fans that we're going to see just some games that have been fixtures on the college football calendar go away. Alabama's three protected rivals are Auburn, obviously. They would never get rid of the Iron Bowl. Tennessee, and Alabama-Tennessee's been a great game. But Mississippi State is the third team for Alabama. For LSU, it's Arkansas, and they've had something with Arkansas over the years since Arkansas, you know, entered the SEC. Ole Miss, LSU Ole Miss has great history, and Texas A&M. So LSU not getting Florida or Alabama as a protected rival is really the biggest gripe, I think, coming from most SEC and college football fans. Florida has Georgia. Of course, we're going to get the, you know, world's largest outdoor cocktail party every year in Jacksonville. Florida, Georgia. Florida also has South Carolina and Kentucky. There are all these SEC schools, just, you know, the additions of Texas and Oklahoma, you know, have made this now something that they've got to go to. This will be a schedule for geographic rivalries that will be looked at every 4 years, which means, based on when this starts, this list will get revisited in the year 2030, but we are going to have an interruption of LSU-Alabama. I mean, in college football over the last 20 years, no two teams have played bigger regular season games consistently year in and year out against each other like Alabama and LSU have. So enjoy it this year. We won't see it starting in 27. I think we'll still see it next year. And then 27, 28, 29, and 30, they will not play. I wanted to just mention one thing and play a piece of sound for you. Javon Kinlaw, what is this from yesterday?
So it was open locker room. Scott okay. Abraham was talking to him, and okay. it was just a media scrum. JP was there as well.
Yeah. So he talked about, you know, feeding off Deron Payne very positively. And then he said about Bobby Wagner's recent game in which he had two sacks and multiple pressures. He said this.
What's it like? Obviously, Bobby is such a leader in the locker room. Mm-hmm. But when you see him get two sacks in a game, considering how much he's already done in football, like, what is that like for the locker room?
The old head still can move, you know what I'm saying? Him and Vaughn, man, it lets you know, shit, I got to get me one too. Nah, but it's been awesome playing around those guys for sure.
Kinlaw, by the way, I've listened to him get interviewed multiple times. He is entertaining. Remember, he's from here. He's having a really good season. This on him being happy playing here in D.C.
You're a couple months into your time here in Washington. It seems like you're really enjoying yourself. Kind of explain your time here so far.
It's been amazing, man. God is the greatest. He allowed me to be here with this great group of men. And even y'all, man, y'all do your job to an exceptional level, man. Y'all are all great people, man. I'm super blessed to be able to be around all these great people for sure.
And how does that impact the way you play, like just of being happy here?
I can just go out and be free. I don't got to be tense. I ain't got to worry about too much. Just do my job, you know?
Javon Kinlaw, this edition, which we debated back in the spring, was a very expensive edition. It has paid off so far. Now, again, the best defensive performances through three games were against the Giants and the Raiders. You know, there will be a big test this Sunday, although the quarterback's a little shaky right now, so we'll see what that looks like. Because if you can make them, I was going to say left-handed, but Michael Penix Jr. is actually left-handed. But if you can take away that run game and force Penix Jr. to beat you, maybe he's not in position to do that right now. But Washington is a better run defensive team than they were a year ago by a lot through three games. Per the normal statistics, they are 12th. As a run defense right now. That is a massive difference from where they were last year. You know, overall, defensively through three games, Washington right now sitting per DVOA at 10th overall. That's impressive through three games. The opponents have something to do with that. They do. The one opponent that was capable shredded them a bit, especially through the air. But man, I think the Kinlaw addition has allowed Payne to play at a high level and Dorrance Armstrong to play at a high level as well. Hopefully it continues this Sunday. The Nats are about to name a new president of baseball ops, and the baseball season has gotten ridiculous here over the last couple of weeks. Mark Zuckerman will join us next to discuss.
All right, happy Thursday, everybody. Here's what's happening. The Nats, they get the win 4-3 over the Atlanta Braves. Andrew Alvarez gets the start, but Mitch Parker comes away being credited with the win. Jose Ferrer comes in, earns the save. James Wood sets the bar pretty high after he reaches 30 home runs for the first time in his career. Nats are off tonight, but they will close out their season at home in a weekend series versus Chicago White Sox tomorrow. Tonight, the Caps, they get going in a preseason matchup versus the Philadelphia Flyers. Puck drop at 7 p.m. That'll be right here on the Team 980. Charlie Lindgren slated to get the start. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live every day from 10 to 1. You can catch Denton's office throughout all football season. Don't forget to hit the like button whenever you do decide to join us and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that is what's trending.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
According to reports, the Nats are on the verge of hiring a new president of baseball operations slash GM. Unclear on that, but here to help us with that is our good friend from Mass and Sports, Mark Zuckerman, at Mark Zuckerman on X on Twitter. He and our good friend Al Galdi host a Nats Chat podcast, which you can get anywhere you get your podcasts. So tell us about Paul Toboni from the Red Sox, 35-year-old, et cetera, and what his position will be, whether or not it's, you know, GM and president of baseball operations both or just one. Let's hear who the Nats just hired.
Yeah, first of all, I believe it's going to be president of baseball operations, and that he will then also have a GM working for him. Now, the thing to understand here, because, you know, we had, you know, decades with Mike Rizzo essentially right. holding both roles or both titles. The way baseball works now, a lot of places, is they've elevated to the top decision maker this title of president of baseball operations with a GM working below them. The GM in those cases is not really the guy in charge, the one making all the final decisions. It's just an elevated title and a sort of right-hand man to help, you know, accomplish a lot of things. So Paul Toboni is going to be in charge of the Nationals from a baseball standpoint, whether he has somebody working underneath him or not. And it's a big move for a young guy, as you said, 35. Now, this is the way the sport's gone in a lot of cases. It's not unusual for someone that young. He's got a decade of experience. And I think what stands out about him, maybe versus some others, there are so many GMs and executives in baseball now with a straight up analytics financial background, not necessarily a straight baseball background. Guys like Mike DiBartolo, who worked in, on Wall Street before going into baseball. In Toboni's case, he played baseball at Cal Berkeley, and he got his MBA from Notre Dame. So he has that side of it, the analytic side of it. But he also spent the last decade working his way all the way up the Red Sox scouting ladder. He started out just as an area scout looking for the next high school star and worked his way up all the way to becoming the guy who was in charge of their draft for 3 years and then ultimately becoming an assistant GM who had a lot of responsibilities for them. So it's kind of that nice sweet spot of a combination of the traditional background and plenty of scouting background while also being very well versed in analytics. And I'm interested to see how he incorporates those two things together. In a perfect world, that's what you want, somebody who has both sides of that equation.
Are you surprised that the Nats were able to attract somebody like this?
A little bit. And his name had come up, but the thought, at least coming out of Boston, was that he was in line to be promoted to the GM of the Red Sox, working underneath their top guy, who was considered the chief baseball officer or something like that.
Yeah.
And the thought would be, well, of course he's going to want to stay with the Red Sox. Now, maybe this is where making him president of baseball operations, really giving him the keys to the car, is what sold him on it. I'm really curious. One of the first things I want to ask him when he's officially introduced is, what did he learn from the Lerner family about this organization? You know, I'm sure he's trying to sell himself to them, but I'm sure they're trying to sell themselves to him as well.
Don't they need to in this sport?
100%. 100%. Yeah. So I want to know, what did he hear from them that convinced him, yes, this is the place I wanted to go? Because presumably as an up-and-comer working for a very good organization in Boston, there were going to be other opportunities for him, whether there or somewhere else. So I want to know, why did this one really stand out to you and say, I need to take this job? I think his answer to that would be pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, do you think, I mean, he probably wouldn't reveal this perhaps, but don't you think he needed some level of commitment, financial and otherwise, from the Lerners before taking this gig?
Yeah, I would think so, or at least a general idea of what they anticipate doing. Now, you know,
I'm not talking about compensation for him. I'm talking about a commitment to the player development, to, you know, free agents, to managers, etc. The learners have a rep here that, like you said, they had probably had to sell themselves to him.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think what is important in his standpoint, you kind of mentioned there, it's not just how much are you going to spend on the major league payroll. It's how much money are you going to give me to build the infrastructure of the organization, to hire player development people, front office staffers, scouts, analysts, everything that we need to have an organization that I believe is going to be good enough to win and compete for championships. So that's all stuff that I would think, if I'm in his position, I want to have some assurances and know what I'm getting into here. You know, do I think they told him, hey, we're going to have a top five budget in the majors? I'm going to guess probably not, but I would hope that whatever they did tell him was satisfactory enough to make him believe that they can be competitive here and that this isn't necessarily a Tampa Bay Rays or Pittsburgh Pirates kind of situation, because that would, I think you would step into that a little more leery of what the future would hold.
Real quickly, for everybody that's not paying close attention to this, tell everybody what's coming down the road with respect to, you know, a collective bargaining agreement and a potential, for the first time ever, salary cap in this sport.
Yeah, this is the underlying thing, not just for the Nationals, but across all of baseball. But it certainly fits in with a lot of what I think the learners are coping with right now and trying to figure out as they map things out the next few years. The CBA expires after next season at the end of 2026. And you're already hearing some pretty serious talk on both sides of the equation, players and owners, about lockouts, about demand, and owners demanding a salary cap, something that they last really tried to do in 1994. How'd that work out? Well, they lost the World Series and they didn't even get their salary cap in the end. The union has always been adamantly opposed to that. Do they think they can pull it off this time? I don't know, perhaps, but they're certainly talking in those terms like they want to do that. So they're definitely gearing up for the potential of some kind of work stoppage in 27 or major changes, and who knows how long that takes. And then on top of that, there's a major issue for MLB with their media rights, their TV rights, that Rob Manfred is openly saying that he hopes to have all 30 teams essentially give up their local TV rights to the league so that it can be packaged as one huge sum to deal out to whoever might want it, and that comes up in 2028. So those are the underlying factors, and if you're the learners, the thought is, are they just biding their time until that's all settled and they're going to kind of stay with the low payroll and go in that direction now? Would you go all in now, or are they thinking, hey, if we're going to have a salary cap in a few years, that changes the whole financial dynamic of it? The TV situation, we know, is a huge deal for them. Whether they would sell the team someday may be tied into all of this. So it's a lot to consider beyond just, you know, what they're looking to do in 2026.
How much does the value of, say, a Nationals, you know, on the open market for sale, how much does it increase the value if there's a salary cap in the sport?
It could. You know, the thought would be, I guess you would say, okay, they would have a better chance of being more competitive by not having to try to spend alongside the Yankees and the Mets and the Dodgers and that kind of thing. So it could. But in theory, that also raises the value of the Pirates and the Royals and the Reds and teams like that. So I think it really boils down to it. I firmly believe that if the learners are ultimately want to sell the team, but they're not going to do it until they get the price number that they want, which they obviously have not gotten yet, what's the best way to get there? To me, it's always been have a better team. You know, have a more successful franchise with more fans and all that kind of stuff. Now, maybe a salary cap helps them get there, but if they're just thinking that alone solves all the issues, I'm not sure that's 100% true, because you see in other sports with salary caps, there are still the bottom feeders who lose every year and are still not effective at winning, no matter what the salary balance may be.
Yeah, and I think the TV thing is also incredibly interesting as it relates to somebody like Ted Leonsis as a potential buyer, because obviously that would be for monumental. But if baseball is controlling the TV part of it for, say, the Nats and many other teams, that's, you know, something we can talk about in the future. Anyway, there are other things I wanted to chat about with you. How would you sort of describe James Wood's season?
Roller coaster, although it was entirely going up for the first half and pretty much going down the second half until the last 2 days. Thankfully, he's hit three homers in the last 2 days, hasn't struck out, and so he may yet salvage this. It's probably the most dramatic one half to the other half I've ever seen from a player. He was so good in the first half, and we're talking about him being a 40-plus homer, iconic season, like among the likes of Bryce Harper and Juan Soto when they were here, and that was legit. That's what he was headed for. Mm-hmm. And the second half, it fell apart, and until just these last couple days, he only hit three home runs since the All-Star break and was striking out at an incredible rate, to the fact that he probably won't get there now thanks to the last few days, but he was on pace to break the all-time single-season strikeout record in Major League Baseball of 223 by Mark Reynolds of the Diamondbacks.
He's eight short of that right now. He's struck out more than anybody in the league this year.
Yeah. So, and it's one thing to say, oh, you strike out a lot, but you're still making great contact. No, that wasn't happening either. So, a huge tail off. Now, I think everybody believes this guy is going to be really good for a really long time. And it was a strange second half with the firings. Maybe the home run derby screwed him up. Give him an offseason to clear his mind, come back spring training with a new manager, new coaching staff, and he should be fine. But it was very discouraging to see that the drop-off be that dramatic and for it to take this long for him to start to get it back together again.
Talking to Mark Zuckerman from Masson, how good has the last few weeks been? I mean, I want to start with just Cleveland. They're on the verge. If they hold off the Tigers and they now have a one-game lead, they finally overcame the Tigers last night in the American League Central. They were 15.5 back on July 8th. They were 10.5 back on September 1st. This would be an all-time comeback since the divisions were a part of it in 1969. I mean, I know for us, football season starts and there's a big shift in attention, but tell everybody what Cleveland is about to accomplish.
Oh, and you just outlined it. It's one of, if not the greatest comebacks ever. And you got to understand, they were not on anybody's radar at all. And Detroit was so far out in front that it was just assumed, oh, they're going to have the best record in the league. And what a great story this has become as a team who had a surprise run last year to make the playoffs. And all of a sudden, they're not assured of anything anymore. They're fighting whether for the division or it would actually be the final wild card the way that's set up. It's now down to them in Houston for the last wild card. And if they miss out, that's a monumental collapse for a franchise that just never thought it was going to be in that position. So it's a huge deal. Caught everyone in the sport by surprise. Now, we knew Cleveland was good last year. They went to the ALCS before losing to the Yankees. They have talent, but the season was not going in that direction for them at all, and Detroit looked far and away the superior team. Cleveland's taken it to them in these last two games that they've been facing head-to-head. You know, I really would like to see Detroit still get in because I think they're a great story. They have Kyle Finnegan, the former Nats closer, in their bullpen. I would love to see them make a run as well, but you can't discount what the Guardians have done. And it's really, it has been a fascinating final week. We don't often get this, where you've got multiple division races and wild card races that look like they're going to go right down at the final day.
I want to make sure I'm clear on this. If we get a bunch of ties, we now have tiebreakers in place to avoid multiple playoff games before the playoffs begin, correct?
Yeah, there's no more game 163. Unfortunately, I loved those when they would come up, that one extra game when it's all said and done.
Yeah.
That you got to go play and
the
you have no time to prep for it. I loved it, but I understand why baseball did this with the three-game wild card series now. Trying to pack that all in and get it done right around Halloween was too much. So it is tiebreakers, and that's why when you look at the standings, and they'll mention it on all these broadcasts that, like, you know, even if the Mets end up tied with the Reds, well, the Reds have the tiebreaker over them, so they have to finish ahead of them in order to get in. So there's a lot of that stuff. It's unfortunate. I love the old method, but I do understand why, you know, there just aren't enough days in the calendar for them to account for those tiebreaker games anymore.
So we've talked about the Cleveland overcoming Detroit. How about what Seattle's done in the American League West? By the way, Houston has not missed the postseason since 2016. They're on the verge of potentially missing the postseason this year unless they can have a big weekend and snag one of the wild cards. But just give me a minute on Cal Raleigh and the Mariners.
The Mariners have had a wonderful season. It's their first division title in 24 years since Ichiro was a rookie in 2001, and they won a record 116 games that year.
Right.
The whole city, the whole Northwest seems to have gotten 100% behind them. And the big reason is the big dumper himself, Cal Raleigh, who last night hit his 59th and 60th home runs. And I know the number 60 doesn't mean what it used to because it's become a little more common the last few decades. But what you got to understand with Cal Raleigh, he's done this as a catcher. And he's not like a part-time catcher. He is a full-time catcher and a good one, a switch-hitting catcher. To hit 60 home runs with the physical demands of that position and to do it in a way that's carrying a team to a division title, maybe even the number one seed in the American League, depending on how it all shakes out, that's why he is a serious contender, if not the favorite, over Aaron Judge for the AL MVP. It's an iconic, memorable season for a guy who really embodies what that team has become.
Yeah, I mean, this probably is more me than maybe the majority of people that are listening, but there's no chance I could have identified Cal Raleigh at the beginning of the season in terms of what team he played on.
No, and there's a lot of people, I'm sure, you know, people in baseball knew who he was, but he had not done anything to this extent. It's such a breakthrough season. It's really just become like this bigger than life situation that he's done. And also keep in mind, just from Seattle standpoint, the Mariners standpoint, they are the only franchise that's never been to the World Series now. The Nationals were the previous one when they got there in 2019 as the Expos and Nationals.
Well, they're the favorite in the American League right now.
Yeah, and I think they deserve to be. It's wide open. There really isn't an obvious favorite this year in either league, I don't think. But if Seattle were to get there, there's a huge emotional component to that. A franchise that's existed since 1977 and is the only one left in the majors that has never reached the World Series.
So, you know, of course I'm going to reach out to you next week again for the playoffs. But right now, while I have you, because I'm looking at the odds, the Phillies are the current favorite to win the World Series. The Mariners are actually second ahead of the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Brewers, who for much of the season looked like the best team in baseball. Is this the year that the Phillies get it done?
It could be, but I really don't feel like anybody is head and shoulders the favorites above anyone else.
Uh-huh.
And in the Phillies' case, their starting pitching has been dominant, and that means a lot, as we know, in the postseason.
But injuries.
Their bullpen, they've had injuries, and their bullpen is incredibly shaky. And we've also seen how big an impact that can make on teams come the postseason. So, I'm hesitant to label anyone as a favorite going into it. I think Milwaukee has had a fantastic season. Another team that you don't necessarily look at the names and they're not going to wow you, but 1 through 26 on their roster, they have contributors everywhere, and they have maintained a pace all year that a lot of teams have gone up and down all year. The Brewers have kind of maintained it throughout, which to me is a good sign of what they're capable of. But this is what, you know, one of the great things and one of the hard things about baseball, you can watch the sport for 162 games and think you know who the best teams are.
Oh yeah.
And all of a sudden you get into a short series, especially the three-game wild card series, and God knows anything can happen. And a team that has a bad bullpen, well, all they need is two guys at the back end who step up at the right moment and can carry you. So I mean,
your team did it a few years ago, the Diamondbacks.
100%. Yeah.
So one other quick question while I have you on the phone, cuz I watched the Kershaw, you know, final, the retirement announcement, his last start. He actually came in last night out of the bullpen. Is he a starter in a playoff series for the Dodgers, or is he in the bullpen?
I thought that was I was watching it too last night. I thought it was a very interesting decision. They're still trying to wrap up the West.
Yeah.
So there was reason.
They got a 2.5 game lead. They should get it done, right?
Yeah. They're in pretty good shape because they won that game in extra innings last night. I'm very fascinated. You talk about injuries. The Dodgers have had a ton of pitching injuries in particular. And yes, they're the Dodgers. They have more depth than anyone else, and they can handle it. But it's very much up in the air how they're going to arrange their rotation, what Kershaw is going to be. He's not the same Kershaw from, you know, years ago. And they acknowledge that, and he acknowledges that, and he knows he's retiring at the end. They've used him in the bullpen in the playoffs before. It hasn't worked out. You may remember
Game 5
in 2019, Soto and Rendon back-to-back. So there's a little bit of that, like, shell shock.
After he had gotten out of the sixth, remember?
Yeah.
And the standing ovation. And the shot of him in the dugout after he gave up the back-to-backs was just amazing from that series.
He was shell-shocked, 100%. Yeah. So maybe there's a little bit in the back of their minds about that. The Dodgers have a... They got to get in first, and they're just about in, but then they got to figure out how are they going about it. And that, to me, is a perfect example of, like, this team that on paper, you know all the star power, they should be one of the favorites, but they've got to piece it all together, and maybe they will, and they'll go on this run, and in the end we'll say, well, clearly the Dodgers were best. Or maybe they're out in three games because they weren't able to get it all together. It would be a fairy tale story for Kershaw, but they've got plenty of question marks as much as anybody else going into it.
Thanks for doing this, as always. I'd love to talk to you next week, too, when we get all the matchups. But I will reach out then. Mark Zuckerman, everybody. Talk to you soon. Enjoy the final weekend.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yep. At Mark Zuckerman on X on Twitter. All right. Up next, we talk college football with our guy Denton Day. This is a phenomenal college football weekend. And by the way, it could start with a big upset opportunity tomorrow night. That's next.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.